This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 29th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 55th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Well, someone had to do it, didn't they? For those not tuned into the commercialised celebrations calendar, it's Halloween this week, a time when all the ghouls of the world put on their best grimaces and make their way out of the usual dank corners in which they reside to spend a bit of time with the rest of us. So this week's Culture Show is dedicated to the dark, the strange and the US elections. Seamless. Coming up, we'll be hearing about the British Film Institute's special re-release of some classic archive BBC ghost stories.
He had a feel for the original material. He actually managed to capture the spookiness and the sort of creeping horror that slowly builds up.
We'll also be hanging out with some ghost hunters in Delhi.
Spirits, please give me an orange light. Oh my God, it's orange!
And talking of strange, US comedian Rich Fulcher rejoins us for an amusing wrap-up ahead of the US elections.
The beef about Obama was like, you're not telling what you're going to do in the next 4 years. So this book's come out, they've just published it, it's like 20 pages, and they're just passing it out to anybody. Dogs, birds in the park.
Plus we'll enjoy a dark and mysterious session from Nordic couple Frost. We'll walk with some lost souls in Vancouver, meet a modern day witch in London, and get a minute of sound from a rather ghoulish Halloween ball. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. All right, let's set the mood now with a bit of haunting music. Nordic duo Frost came into Midori House last week to perform for the Monocle team, and from that session here is Sex Shooter. I want you to pull my trigger, baby. I can do it alone. I want you to be my main thing, plain thing, pillar of stone. I'm a sex shooter, shooting love in your direction. I'm a sex shooter, come and play with my affections. Come on, kiss the That was Frost with Sex Shooter from their Midori House session, and more haunting melodies from them later in the show.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight.
To kick off our Halloween theme, we're off to Hollywood. And what better place to get the gossip on last year's trends and what's gracing the gates of Partyland than the Dells of Hollywood? It's one of the oldest costume shops around, a family-owned business, which has been open since 1945. Reporter Adelaide Chan popped in to meet its owner, Adele Sadie.
It is the busiest time, and we look forward to it each and every year.
Are there people fighting over costumes?
They're not fighting over costumes. They're more couples fighting over who's going to wear what and who looks better than what, you know. But otherwise, they're quite fun because everybody's going to dress and have fun. So they come in here in a happy mood.
Okay, so what are some of the top sellers this year?
This year there has been the superheroes because of that superhero movie that came out. So a lot of the guys are there. And then forever there is the Pirates of the Caribbean. Everybody wants to be Jack Sparrow.
That's not even a current film.
No, it's not. A lot of the stuff goes back further, I think. It has a traditional and a classical sense. There are some movies that never die, like Batman, Superman, Spider-Man. You know, a lot of these characters stay on. And they improve them from year to year, but it's cool. And the kids love them, too, because we have children's costumes.
Okay, you were telling me that traditional costumes are popular this year, too.
You want to come with me and I'll show
yes.
you? Now we have the 60s over here. Then we have the movie queens, like the movie stars like Marilyn and Jean Harlow and Kidman, Nicole Kidman. All the stuff is over here. And then we have the ever most popular lady, who is Marie Antoinette and Scarlett O'Hara. They always top the list because the guys can dress with Scarlett as General Lee or something, you know. And then they can, Rhett Butler we had one request for. Most of the ladies want to go as Scarlett with the General Lee combo.
Very elegant.
Yeah, it's the most beautiful costume. So I admire their taste in that respect.
And we should say that we are absolutely surrounded by gowns where we're standing. We're standing in a narrow hallway just filled with gowns.
Yeah, we have a lot of beautiful gowns. And when the ladies put them on with the hoop skirts, you can't resist. They look gorgeous. That look never dies, you know? We might go, there's a lot of this Lake Avenue, which produces sexy costumes. That is very popular too, but it's usually for young ladies with lovely figures, you know, because otherwise you can't wear a skirt that's 12 inches. But they look cute on the ladies.
You said you designed that?
Yeah, I designed most of the better quality costumes over here. Like this. This is Napoleon. This is, let me see, General Lee and George Washington over here in his soldier outfit. They're really beautiful. So the people really go for them.
Oh, that's funny.
And on this side we have the monks, nuns, space. Then we have the bullfighter, which is very popular with the male species. And the most popular of all costumes is the gorilla. Every man must be a gorilla once in a lifetime during Halloween. It's a horribly hot costume, but it doesn't faze them to wear this hot costume. They love to wear it. It's amazing. They come out and say, wow, in this rubber mask that fits over their head, but they love it. And Darth Vader was popular this year. That's why I love Halloween. People want to get away from all this, what's going on with the economy and the political scene and all that junk all around us and violence, whatever. You come here, you escape it all, and you become whoever you want to be. It takes away from the reality of the everyday life.
Well, do you breathe a sigh of relief when Halloween is over?
Yes, and I hope it comes right back. I said, because I love Halloween. It gets me so... I can work 24 hours a day without getting tired. My kids go, Mom, you're not tired yet? I said, no, because it gives me great joy to see everyone having so much fun.
That was Adele Sadie, owner of costume shop Adele's of Hollywood. And now you know what to wear. Let's get on with the rest of the show. Rarely can we imagine a more classic component of culture designed to haunt than the ghost story. Originally spoken, then written, as film evolved, it made its way onto our screens too. Horror is as old a movie genre as the medium itself, dating back to the late 19th century. While many people think of the big screen as the classic place for horror to be seen, television's also proved a fruitful medium for the genre, especially in Britain. Culture producer Katie Bilboa recently caught up with Dick Fiddy, an expert on TV history from the British Film Institute. Dick popped into Midori House to talk about the BFI's recent re-release of 12 classic BBC ghost stories, most adapted from novels by recognised writer M.R. James and directed by Lawrence Gordon Clark, and are considered hugely influential in their field. After a night of hiding behind her sofa, Katie asked Dick to explain a little more.
Well, back in the 70s, the BBC embarked on a series of annual ghost stories, usually directed by a guy called Lawrence Gordon Clark, and they were pretty spooky stuff. They were pretty cleverly done. They were quite cheap, but shot on film, so they looked perhaps a little more lush than other television at the time. And the first few stories are based on the works of M.R. James, who's now regarded as probably the greatest ghostwriter in the English language. James' themes usually were about academics researching something, probably not, in fact, believers themselves, who stumble upon ancient secrets and horrible supernatural forces. So we decided that it's about time that these were out and available on DVD and Blu-ray. And they have been available sporadically before at different times, but not all together. This is the first time that all of them have been available in one box set. So basically, that was what we were working towards.
Mr. Paxton, what is the matter?
It's nothing, really. I've had a bit of a shock, that's all. That figure's gone again.
It's for the light plays tricks. Perhaps he was never there.
And how significant are these productions? I mean, how much of a reaction has there been? Has there been a quite high demand for them to be released?
Yes, I think they're very culty. The people that saw them at the time, they really live with you. They actually are quite effective and haunting. And especially if you were younger when you saw them, you know, like all things, there's a hint of nostalgia as well as that tingle of fear. So I think for people that are around at the time, they do remind them of that period. For people that weren't around at the time, it's quite a revelation when they discover them. It's not like, I mean, you may get the idea you're going to find something a bit creaky and perhaps doesn't quite work anywhere. And you often think to yourself, well, you know, in this day of special effects and CGI, we can do anything and make things really terrifying. But these don't work like that. These are much more stories of the mind. They're quite spooky. They're quite haunting. And, of course, they benefited from being on TV because it wasn't like seeing something at the cinema when you had that moment afterwards when you could go home. You could escape, if you like. You had to walk home or the bus ride home. Here, very soon after these went out, the TV would have closed down for the night. So you turn off the TV and there you are left with the ghost story still sort of haunting your living room and perhaps going to bed with you just half an hour later. So, you know, I think they did sort of play on the mind of people, which is perhaps why they're so fondly remembered.
One of the ones that I've seen is A Warning to the Curious. When I watched that, I just thought Hitchcock. I could really see elements of Hitchcock's style in that. How influential do you think he was on that production?
Actually, I think the influence is all from M.R. James. Recently, when this box set came out, I reread a couple of the short stories, and I was amazed at just how much that you see on the screen is actually in those stories. So, yes, you might, you know, obviously, anyone that makes sort of visually spooky stories must look at the masters like Hitchcock and people like that. But a lot of the atmosphere and the elements that you think might come from film are actually there in the short stories in the first place.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Let's talk about some of the techniques that he uses as a director, because, I mean, landscape struck me as a huge factor, definitely, in A Warning for the Curious.
I think you find, yes, I think landscapes, the bleakness of the atmosphere, because most of them are period pieces, well, they are period pieces, he manages to capture the feel of sort of empty space very, very well. And they're sort of paganistic as well. Even though you've got what's supposedly a modern man, some sort of academic at the centre of the thing, when they're confronted by the evils they're confronted with, they are medieval. They are from a different time period. They come haunting back. And I think he was very good at using spaces, stones, old houses, trees, to actually capture that atmosphere. So, yes, locations are very, very important to these.
Yeah. And he's got a wonderful way of kind of building up tension as well, hasn't he? I was genuinely scared when I watched them.
Yeah, I remember some years ago when we did a season of these, my colleague had to watch, and she hadn't seen them, she had to watch them all in the vaults down in the basement at Stephen Street of the BFI. And she was really genuinely spooked out by it because, you know, she saw two or three of them. She had to come back to the office to get a cup of tea because now suddenly every creak, every footfall, every noise on the stairs, every time the radiator turned on, it just terrified her, you know.
Yeah, and it makes me think that must be a sign of a good director, because even though you watch it now and you can see it's a bit dated, but you still feel that it's brilliantly done.
I think what happened as well is that times changed, and the sort of ghost stories and horror stories that people started to want to see in the 80s and 90s were much more gory. And I think they sort of... They weren't as interested anymore on these, if you like, haunting mind pieces. They wanted jumps. They wanted things to come flying out of wardrobes, you know, and full-blooded gore. So I think they do stand for their time. I mean, perhaps it's not the sort of thing you could make now.
I know these are very specifically kind of British stories, but do we see any other examples kind of internationally of directors or television producers that have chosen to use this genre?
Yeah, I mean, horror is big all over the world, and different types of horror. There's a very certain type of Argentine horror or Spanish horror story, or the great Italian greats, Mario Bava and Argento and people like that, that make a completely difference. So Spain and Italy have turned out some interesting directors as well, and there is now a tradition of horror from those countries. But I think the idea of the classic British ghost stories is in fact quite international. It's like Sherlock Holmes in that way. People do understand it. They're sort of used to seeing a 19th century Britain shrouded in fog and the atmosphere that you get with it. So, you know, I think those things do have an international appeal.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We'll be meeting some ghost hunters in Delhi after this.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're looking at some dark tales for Halloween. The Indian capital, Delhi, has a long, proud tradition of ghosts. Its former Islamic rulers brought with them the notion of djinns, which are spirits believed to be formed from smoke, like genies. And now it's believed that the ghosts of former British soldiers still patrol parts of the city. A tour company called Let's Get Packing a few months ago launched ghost tours of the city in conjunction with the Indian Paranormal Society, the brainchild of commercial pilot Gaurav Tiwari. Monocle's New Delhi correspondent, Aarti Bettigeri, met up with the ghost tour founders in the inner city cemetery, where there are said to be a few resident ghosts, although not as many as another British Raj-era cemetery a few kilometres away, according to Let's Get Packing's Aryan Sakdeva.
Nicholson Cemetery is one of the oldest cemeteries in the city. It was built initially for the British men, women and children who were killed in the 1857 mutiny. That's when the Mughals, their followers and a lot of Indian soldiers with the British East Indian Company rose up against their employers, so to speak. The cemetery is named after Brigadier Nicholson, who was killed by a sniper, but is said to roam the grounds of Nicholson Cemetery in a headless form.
And has anyone seen anything there?
Well, we personally haven't witnessed Brigadier Nicholson in his headless form, but if you ask any of the locals there, and a lot of them have been living there for generations, they will swear that even to this day, you can see Brigadier Nicholson taking rounds on his horse without a head.
Headless horseman of Old Delhi.
Yes.
I have to admit, I'm a complete skeptic. I don't believe in ghosts, I don't believe in an afterlife, I don't believe in other world. but I'm very willing to be convinced. I understand you've got a bag full of ghost-busting, ghost-hunting equipment here. Can we maybe give it a test run?
Yeah, sure. We don't want to convince you that ghosts exist or no, but these equipments are meant to find out any abnormality in the atmosphere, in temperature variations, electromagnetic fluctuations. And there are also equipments like Ghost Box, which is able to, it is said that using Ghost Box, you may be able to communicate with spirits and ghosts.
Okay, so in your hands, you've got two pieces of equipment. Both are about the size of, well, one's about the size of a TV remote control, and in fact, looks like a TV remote control with a meter reading on top with various colors, green through to red, and the other one looks like a walkie-talkie. What are these?
The machine with lights on it is K2 meter. It basically detects electromagnetic fluctuation. There are different lights on it. As we put it on, it can read the electromagnetic fluctuation in the environment. We use this to communicate with spirits and ghosts. It is said if there is a particular electromagnetic field in the atmosphere, it will show you the variation. But if you ask questions and if you ask the spirits to give you three or two lights, and if there is a positive communication established on this this machine, this piece of equipment, we suppose that there is something intelligent coming from the other world. Because it's not easy to make electromagnetic field fluctuate with your own commands. Suppose if you ask, give us three lights, if you're here, if you get three lights, and then again ask, give us four lights, if you're here, we get four lights, and we ask different questions using the pattern of lights, like three lights for yes and two lights for no, and if you're getting positive communication on this, then it is definitely coming from some other world.
Okay, so we're in a cemetery. We're in no better place to ask for spirit intervention. So spirits, please give me an orange light. Oh my God, it's orange. Give me two greens. Nope, nothing. Is anyone there? Give me a red for yes. Oh my God, the lights just flick. So what's this other?
This is a PSB7 spirit box. What it does basically, it has different modes to sweep between FM and AM frequencies of the radio. Spirit and ghost can manipulate these radio waves and they can speak out through this machine. What we do, we put it on a rate of 200 milliseconds, which is the rate of sweeping between the different channels of AM and frequency modulation FM channels. And once we start it, it can sweep forward or sweep back.
Do I need to ask a question?
Yeah. Is there anyone with us here? Please say something if you can listen to me, if you can hear me. I'm here to speak with you. I want you to say something.
What's that?
The noise is called the white noise. It helps spirit speak their words. They provide that particular audio energy to the spirit so that they can speak. We usually spend the entire night, you know, searching for some intelligence, out of the world intelligence, which is not human. So just coming here and spending a few hours doesn't mean that we can really find something here.
That was ghost hunter Arjun Sachdeva talking to Aarti Bhattacharya in Delhi. Now for another Halloween hit, this time in Vancouver. Forget those sexy nurse and fireman outfits. In the edgiest part of the Canadian city, the community hosts an original carnival of apocalyptic visions and spirits to send the dearly departed into the next life. Amid the chaos of costumes and props, Lucy Hislop dropped in on Ari Laser, the organiser of the Parade of Lost Souls and Secret Souls Walk.
Welcome to Halloween, East Vancouver style, and the buzzing headquarters of the Lost Souls Parade and Secret Souls Walk, a pop-up performance night that draws 20,000 people who only learn the location the night before. This year, it's all about the end of the world, according to Ari Laser, its artistic producer.
This year, our secret location is down in an industrial district, a little off of Commercial Drive, and so we're in amongst these big, old buildings, big factories, run-down alleyways, spray-painted dead ends, corrugated metal turned up. From an artistic standpoint, it's hands down the most beautiful urban environment I've ever had the honor of putting a show on in.
It started as a walk 20 years ago to gather up all the dearly departed that had been lost or forgotten in the area. Those, as Laser puts it, who hadn't left the world in a good way or been remembered enough. With more than 200 volunteers and performers, including his troupe, the Dusty Flowerpot Cabaret, looks like every soul is guaranteed a good send-off from the neighbourhood this year, and all in great style.
When we start on the walk, we will start out of the park through a grove of trees, through a very beautiful haunting gamelan performance, out onto the streets where theatrically we're going to watch all hell begin to break loose. There are visions of a slow motion riot in the streets. There are flickering TVs and projections showing images from a police state with revolution burgeoning at its borders. The lighter forces are these beautiful spirit deer, these white clothed, stilting creatures that sort of roam tall through the alleyways. There are these amazing trees built out of found pallet wood. So all of the detritus we've been seeing strewn through the alleys to this point starts to take a new life to itself. And pieces are being reassembled in a new way.
By donation affair, it seems a far cry from the usual commercialization of Halloween in North America, from the vampires to the naughty nurses. For Laser, its popularity is obvious.
Well, I think what makes this event so special is that most of the patrons who come, probably 80 or 90% of the people who come to the event, come in costume, which, when you're at an interdisciplinary, interactive arts event, makes all the difference. Because when people are in costume, they're also in character. They have the freedom to be somebody that they're not in their everyday life. I really think it's this one day a year where we get to relinquish the burden of the character we've created for ourselves, this part of me that has a job and responsibilities and a certain set of likes and wants, and we get to put on a whole new facade, a whole new character for ourselves.
For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
And you are tuned in to Culture on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we'll be hearing more of that haunting session from Frost. We'll meet the British artist who recreated the walk taken by the victims of the Pendle witch trials back in the 1600s. We'll have a minute of sound from a ghoulish ball and meet the creepiest of them all, Rich Fulcher, to get his take on the race to the White House as we enter the last days of the presidential election. Pretty dark stuff, huh? So, time to hear more of that haunting Nordic session from Frost. Here they are with their latest single, Something New.
Feather tried to point out the direction, but he forgot to notice the signs. He'd been in search for utter pure perfection, but ended up being left behind. A very cold and calculating when he had his inklings of doubt. She was not as he'd anticipated, but he knew we couldn't do without. Thank you.
That was Frost with their latest single, Something New, which they performed live for us last week here at Midori House. And afterwards, producer Paul Noble grabbed them for a quick chat.
This is our sort of Halloween special. Mm. And the music you make is also, there's something quite dark and mysterious about that.
Well, is it? I mean, it's just we're Scandinavian, I guess. We're used to the forest and the darkness. I mean, where we live, it's dark a couple of months every year. So that's not so scary. It's just kind of magical.
So you're based in Tromsø, but you were in Oslo before.
Yeah.
Obviously, Oslo has a reputation as a very creative musical hub. There's the whole Norwegian disco mafia all working with each other in various studios. You've left that behind and sort of hibernated somewhere a bit more quiet? Yeah,
it's our hometown, Tromsø. We come from the Arctic, and it's 2,000 kilometres north of Oslo. And I mean, I've been living in Oslo for 18 years, and that same scene is very much a part of it. But we needed a change. We wanted to do something else and move north. And I guess it's just got drawn towards this, as you say, the dark and mysterious part of life. I think what's going on in the north now is fairly interesting for some undefinable reason. It's a lot of talk about the Arctic and northern areas, and obviously we have a quite severe crisis going on with, especially in, if you go as far as Svalbard, where we played a gig a few months ago, you can actually see and touch what everybody's talking about, and you can really feel it on yourself.
You're referring to the environment specifically?
Yes, right. I am.
And do you find your music taps into perhaps some of that sort of looming sense of menace?
Well, maybe that's the kind of threatening danger that you can feel if you say it's dark. It's the kind of cliffhanging feeling of society as such today.
So let's talk about Something New, which is a single from your new album. I've just seen the video recently. It's fairly epic. How would you? I mean, there's a big backstory to this video. How would you describe it?
Yeah, it's just 8 minutes long. That's
The standard industry standard single.
Yeah, it's not Lord of the Rings.
No, it's not. No, but it's.
But you've done something. Something quite adventurous.
Yeah, because we did this special event. It's called Pyramiden. This is an abandoned Russian settlement in Spitsbergen, or Svalbard, as we call it, which is. Well, it's a ghost town, really. It was left 14 years ago, and everything has been just untouched since then. It's just really, really cold, no electricity, and lots of dust. And we have this connection to this place for several reasons, and we decided to make an event there. So we did a concert, and we brought equipment and people, and we had a beautiful concert. And then also we did this film that turned out to be Something New.
And as well as, you obviously took equipment and video equipment there, did you have to take an audience? Because surely there's no one there to hear the music.
There's no one there. There's a few caretakers there in the summer, a few Russians working there. But no, people had to come by boat 3 hours from Longyearbyen, which is the Norwegian settlement, like the main area where you can fly to. Mm-hmm. It's like 2 hours flight from Tromsø, so it's pretty remote, pretty cold.
So these are very committed Frost fans.
Well, absolutely. But also I think the whole thing about waking this dead city alive, it hasn't been anything going on there except from some tourists looking at this area. And it was very special. The Russians, they were almost crying because they had this something. It was alive again. And they had the foyer was full of people. They were serving drinks and baked cakes and all that. And it was just very kind of beautiful to wake it up again. And we were standing there on stage and it was so dusty. I thought we had this hazer, this machine mm-hmm. to create kind of haze, but it was just dust and all kind of equipment just left behind and posters from previous show. So yep. Very special.
Sounds like a great horror film in the making.
In some sense it's kind of feel it's haunted and it's very dark, but it's most of all beautiful, I think, because the idea of the place was to build a perfect, ideal city, and they put so much effort into making it. It's a very beautiful place, so it's more sad that it's abandoned. I think it's like lots of good memories.
Yeah,
hanging
there are
on
ghosts there, but they're from a more positive kind
yeah.
of
right.
time.
So yeah,
it's kind friendly, of good, ghosts.
Friendly ghosts.
Yeah, friendly right. ghosts.
Good
yeah.
vibes.
Very good vibes in Pyramiden.
That was Algie Pettersen and Per Martinsen, a.k.a. Frost. And we'll hear one more track from their magical session at the end of the show. You're listening to a Halloween special of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Lancashire's Pendle witch trials of 17th century England, in which 10 people were hanged, are some of the most infamous in British history. They occurred against a backdrop of monarchical paranoia and complex local politics, a history not always reflected in simplified representations of broomsticks and cauldrons. Jo Hesketh is a modern-day witch and, handily, an artist from Pendle itself. She wanted to get to the truth of what happened in the trials and decided to walk the same journey that the accused were forced to take some 400 years ago. The huge haunting oil paintings which followed have been on tour through the north of England and have just made their way to London. Culture producer Katie Bilboa went to meet Joe and curator Simon Desmond to find out more.
Anyone that knows Pendle, they always think of witches and pointed arts and all that. I mean, I think I go on about it enough because I'm from the area, you know. So I thought, right, Joe, just get it together and just know the real story. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to, as my title of my show says, investigate, you know, do the full investigation of what actually went on. And so I actually did the walk because I wanted it to sink into my mind in the place where they actually went and were taken. And it really worked. It was unbelievable.
So just explain a little bit more about this walk. Where did you go from and where did you go to and what did you discover as part of that journey?
I went from Pendle Border, where basically, supposedly, Damdike's house was, and I walked all the way through the Trafford Borland to Golgotha, where they were hung in Lancaster. You wouldn't believe how much the story went in my head while I was walking. I mean, days on your own, in the middle of nowhere, there's no noise, no nothing. You might get an odd car going through now and again, but basically, me and the dog were on our own, and it starts creeping in, and it just takes you back to that place. You've got twisted trees, and you've got everything that were there then. You know, a bit of tarmac might spoil it, but still, most of the track was the same.
And now the exhibition's coming to its final close in London. I just wondered, Simon, maybe you could explain the significance of it coming to the capital and how that kind of ties in with some of the history of the story as well.
For me, yes, it was a logical thing to bring it back to London, to where James I had his court. To put it into some sort of context, the absurdity of the whole thing, why you round up 10 or 11 local people, including children, and you end up hanging them. You know, I think, who was the youngest? The youngest must have been...
Well, they didn't hang the youngest, but she gave the evidence to put them all down, which is ridiculous, yeah. 8-year-old.
Eight years old, yeah. In court. Later on, James I actually appoints someone called the Witchfinder General.
40 years later.
Who works on a commission basis to find witches and to get rid of them. James wants to get rid of anyone who might be a threat to him or his descendants. That in itself, you know, it's an absurd idea because anyone who's working on commission is going to find as many witches as possible. And I think this whole thing relates to the Pendle witch trials, that same sort of, I suppose, absurdity. And you see it in Jo's pictures where she's got a local person who's obviously in prison and is on trial, and there's someone whispering in his ear or her ear, and it's, you know, to say the right thing, to manipulate it, to manipulate the evidence. And it was taking something very, very small, a slight against one person to another, you know, I don't like you, whatever, and ending up with executing, was it 10 people, 11 people? And that's really what we're remembering this year, is 1612, is about that rather than broomsticks and witches.
What do they look like, the paintings? What would they see if they walked into the gallery? What would be in front of them?
In my eyes, they take you back to that place 400 years ago. You know, they've got the dress code, as it were. I've tried to drag it into my life, I guess. I live in Pendle. I know what it's like. And some people haven't moved on at all in 400 years, you know. A lot of people have, but certain people haven't. You've got to relate it to your own life, haven't you? Anything that anyone looks at relates it to themselves to get any kind of feeling from anything. So I just had to put myself in the Pendle thing and, you know, what people are like that are controlling and, you know, trying to have the power over other people. And that's what I tried to do. I tried to do the contemporary angle on it.
I certainly see it on a political level where, you know, particularly with the abuses that have gone through the system recently with politicians, with the press, and how ordinary people get mixed up in it and end up getting stung and hurt. And really, it's got very little to do with them. It's more the power mongers at the top. And I think, you know, a lot of the messages through those images is that.
And how do you think it's impacted on the way people in Pendle and the north of England maybe, or how much they know about these trials or how they view them, given that maybe their experience so far has been seeing a bus with a picture of a witch in a hat on it?
People want it to be Disney. They want it.
Well, yeah, I guess they do.
You know, when I came up originally to see you and your friends, and we spent a night together in a house where they were doing the things with herbs and stuff like that.
They were wishing me on my way. They were doing well wishes to make sure I was safe on my journey. So we do some stuff in the fire.
To me, it was kind of, there was an authenticity to it, which didn't involve, you know, a lot of cackling old women. You only have to look at the architecture and everything around there, Gothic architecture, and you see the sort of Gnostic side, the earlier beliefs coming through. And this was still very prevalent to people at the time. And what we call a witch is probably someone who looks at the moon or looks at a bird flying low or, you know, to see how the crops are going to grow or and that side of things and reads into nature, reads into what's going on around them.
You're describing me, by the way.
Pretty well. Yeah. I mean, your hair is covered in bugs at the moment.
Watching them birds swoop.
And you're wearing a curtain.
That was bewitching artist Jo Hesketh and our curator Simon Desmond talking to Katie Bilboa. And Jo's show, A Pendle Investigation, opens on Halloween at the Newman Street Gallery, running until the 24th of November. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We'll be catching up with Rich Fulcher after this. For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch. Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. There's a Halloween focus this week, but we're going to deviate from the theme a little here. For while this man is something of a comedy deviant and a renegade, he's not really scary. We caught up with Rich Fulcher earlier on in the presidential election campaign, and with just days to go now, we invited him back into Midori House to give us his take on the debates and final days of the campaigns. He stopped by and caught up with Tom Edwards.
The debates have played more of a role in this election than just about any other election. It's crazy. I don't understand it. But, you know, the thing is, nobody really knew Romney. And I think a lot of the problem with the first debate, because basically Obama was asleep during the first debate. And everybody thinks, you know, of course, Romney did the better of the two presentationally. But the problem is, nobody really knew much about Romney, and they go, I'm going to find out during the debates. And it just so happened that's the one time Romney did well in anything, and that's the impression they got. So we got a huge bounce. Now, two things. One, normally the incumbents lose the first debate. I think out of all the, like, eight times, only Clinton beat Dole, and he was already an incumbent. So it's not a weird thing for that to happen. But second of all, there were, like, 2 weeks for Romney to, like, build the momentum from that first debate. So it was a bit of a problem because, you know, Obama had to wait till the second debate and say, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to do something. And then it finally he did. I think overall Obama did better in the debates, but the first one had the biggest impact.
And I just wonder how does that play? I mean, we sort of have this expectation of America being obsessed with image, and I think skeptics say, oh, it's all a bit superficial. But do you think, you know, a kind of statesman-like hour, an hour and a half, can that really get traction across the whole nation, or are people a bit more cynical than that?
Well, I don't know. I think there are two debates. One is the people watching the debate, and then the spin from the debate. Like, because everybody after the first, sometimes it didn't have as much effect because all people saw was that, you know, Romney wanted to cut Big Bird from PBS. So it's like Obama was smart. The next day he goes out saying, Romney wants to cut Big Bird. And then everybody cheers. And then that's all they get out of the debate. So it's a lot of it has to do with that. And the spin room, you know, apparently that's like the big deal is right after the debate, the handlers just change everything.
I just wonder, what do you reckon about that? Because we were talking about Romney's, you know, inner circle, there's pictures of him, you know, getting on a plane and waving. Do you think they say to him, look, the polls are close, we can really win this? Or do you think they're a bit more pragmatic? And what's that? What's the environment like around, you think, someone like Romney? Do you think he's... It's hard to read him, I think, in terms of what he's like behind closed doors.
Yeah, I think he basically runs the show, but he doesn't mind being deluded. Like, you're winning, Romney, you're winning. They call him Romney, by the way. Robot Romney. No, and they say he's winning. And, you know, you can make the... Because he's often lying in the middle of a lie. You know, he changes his tune so much. So I can't imagine him not lying to himself that he's winning this thing.
And just looking at the sort of the bigger picture, you know, across the whole country, one thing that always intrigues me is how the candidates try and get their message across in these frantic last few weeks.
Semaphore.
Well, yeah. I sometimes wonder that they should strip it down to the basics like that. What do you make of the messages? You mentioned the Big Bird advertising campaign. Is there a kind of a subtlety, or do you think it's just at this point the gloves are off and they just go for it to try and get any kind of press they can, any kind of traction?
I think Romney's not talking to the press right now, which is weird because there's a lot of stuff going on with this Murdoch thing, whatever. But Romney is like attrition. I think he feels like he's got a lead. He's going to sit on it. Obama's doing a lot of aggressive things. Like, he's coming out with his plan. He's got a book that's... Because a lot of the, you know, the beef about Obama was like, you're not telling what you're going to do in the next 4 years. So this book's come out. They've just published it. It's like 20 pages. And they're just passing it out left and right to anybody. Dogs, birds in the park. But and you know, that's like an aggressive, and he's also talking about Romneysia, like, if, you know, he's constantly changing his mind and stuff. And Obama's talking to the press. So it looks like he's doing a lot more than Romney right now.
Have you been surprised by Obama? I mean, a lot of the rhetoric from 2008 was very statesmanlike, very, you know, big grand designs, big sort of pictures that he was going to paint on the international stage. Now he's, you know, talking Romneysia. Do you feel like...
I know.
Is that disappointing? Do you think he's not being the statesman he could have been?
Well, I mean, I appreciate his fighting for the campaign now, but I don't think he had to be in that situation. I think if he had just been a little bit more forceful in selling his programs during the 4 years, I think he just sort of like assumed, hey, I passed healthcare. What do you think of that? And in the meantime, all the Republicans were gathering up steam. And then, you know, 2010 elections happened and it just went, you know, south for the, which is normal that the non-incumbents, you know, start to gain seats in the House and the Senate. But it just became a little bit like Obama was, come on, talk about health care. It's good. To be honest, I find it difficult to see how Obama will not win.
That was Rich Fulcher, and he's performing his special US election show on Monday, the 5th of November, at the Soho Theatre in London. Back to the ghostly theme now, because last week, culture producer Katie Bilboa donned her finest ghoulish attire and attended Satan's Rout, a Halloween ball in an abandoned picture palace in southeast London. It was staged by the Last Tuesday Society, a pataphysical organisation founded by William James at Harvard in the 1870s, who regularly host devious and intriguing events at various locations around London. Here's her minute of sound.
Yeah.
That was A Minute of Sound from Satan's Route in London. The event was in celebration of Suzetta Field's new book, A Curious Invitation, which lists the 40 greatest parties in literature, and it's out now. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be dropping the frights in favour of a less ghoulish show, we promise. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher mixed this all up in her witch's cauldron of radio magic. Time for one final song this week from the Midori House session. This is Frost with The Woods. Thank you for tuning in.
Two bare feet in the middle of the night, the beat, the wind. You run till you feel the taste in your mouth of blood, of heat. So this is the night to change your life, to find, to seek. So don't look back, don't go too deep. Cause you are the one that could sweep me off my feet. You're dragging me slowly into the woods. And you are the one that can wipe my mind with ease. You're dragging me slowly into the cold hands in the middle of the woods, up to no good. Now go with the wind into the storm. Your pounding heart will keep you warm. Feel awake, it's far too late to steep, to turn. So don't look back, 'cause you're gone.